So we'll get on with World Watchers, and if you want to contribute, that's fine. Just let the station know. Reach is waiting for you. He's anxious to hear if you want to contribute to the station. P.O. Box 206, Pacific Grove, California, 93950. And this is Mae Brussel, and this is KAZU, K-A-Z-U, in Pacific Grove, California.
The views expressed by Mae Brussel during World Watchers are those of the commentator and do not reflect the opinions of KAZU, its board of directors, or staff.
Do you hear the card on? I put it on and I swear I do not hear it each week. When it plays later at the end of the program, but there's something on the board here that doesn't work for me, not like it should. And I hear the clock outside and it's 8 o'clock. This is Mae Brussel, and it is broadcast number 625, November 28, 1983. Another one of those months that has rolled away. They go pretty fast, don't they? I usually begin by describing the events that took place last year, and oh my goodness, what happens in November each year just seems to be tremendous. There's always a big story. The story last year was the Vatican Bank, how the Vatican got itself implicated in the Banco Ambrosiano scandal. That was just last year in the Wall Street Journal, and the accounts of the tangled money of the bank with Milan, with the offices in Milan that were busted. The import-export agency Stibam, S-T-I-B-A-M, the international transport company, and the interlocking links of Milan to Banco Ambrosiano to New York to Liechtenstein. And it had to do with drug dealers, international gangs of arms dealers, illegal exports to Iran and to Middle East countries from Europe, military hardware traded mainly for heroin sold in Europe, run by Henry Arsan, 70 years old from Syria, with an Italian wife. Their offices were in the Banco Ambrosiano building, and the bust took place last November, and it was in June that Roberta Calvi, the president of Banco Ambrosiano, who worked with the Vatican, was found murdered in London. So from June until November, this story was surfacing, and then the arms and the drugs linked not only to Roberta Calvi but to the Vatican Bank. And at that moment, the Pope brought in Mr. Hermann Abst. He worked for him during World War II. The Pope worked for Solvay Chemical, which is IG Farben, and Hermann Abst was on the board of IG Farben, the head of the Deutsche Bank in Germany. He wrote the paychecks for Heinrich Himmler and Adolf Hitler. And he was brought in to the Vatican to help find or replace the $1.2 billion that was missing from the dummy fronts in the Bahamas and in Panama. They've never yet come up with much about that money. It's still secret. This was a year ago that these stories were breaking. In the last year, a new Jesuit priest replaced the other one. The Jesuits were getting too liberal. Mr. Abst has got the Pope to crack down on all priests who are doing liberal church work. You can be a fascist like Lech Walesa. You can fight communism, but you can't fight poverty or social repression. And in the United States, the Pope has some big appointments to make. And Mr. Hermann Abst is working with the Vatican. In the past year, I learned that he actually was the head of Opus Dei. That's the lay organization that raises funds for business people. Very, very conservative, secret organization. And it turns out in this last year that Hermann Abst is the head of the Opus Dei, and the Opus Dei has as its head the man who wrote the paychecks for the entire Nazi operation and now works in the Vatican for the Pope, who worked for him at Auschwitz for IG Farben. It was Solvay Chemical. Those stories were breaking just a year ago, and of course they're still unresolved, except that Abst is still there. The new Jesuit priest has taken over, and he's more stringent. There is no revealing, and never will be, of where the money went, the dummy fronts. the Vatican money that disappeared out of Panama, if it's funding fascism, Nazism, oppression, or whatever. There's no indication of where that money went or what it's used for. Now, the Rebel is out. We talked about that earlier on the first part of this program. You can get the Rebel around the United States, wherever you get these tapes. There's a city, I'm sure, where you can get it. If you're somewhere where you can't get it, I'll get a copy for you if you're a long listener to World Watchers. That's the prerequisite. You have to be a long member of World Watchers, 5 years or more. And I'll send you I said I would for the holidays anyway, if you can't obtain it. A lot of people are obtaining it. Larry Flint sent out broadcast number 617 and 618. I told you that to every member of Congress. He spent $6,000 for that. And for the first time in my 20 years research, I got a telephone call from the member of the Congressional Committee from a particular office in Washington, D.C. First we didn't get any answer from the congressman. Mr. Proxmire, William Proxmire, sent his back and said he doesn't listen to tapes. But Leon Panetta, our congressman, wrote to me and said if I can be of any more assistance. So that meant there were like 518 that didn't answer. But one of them that I didn't get a direct letter from, and I won't mention his name because something may happen between now and when I meet with the Congressional Committee. I'm very superstitious about telling these things in advance because something funny happens on the way to getting the truth out. Some representatives from Washington, D.C. will be with me, thanks to a particular congressional committee, and I think I owe this to Larry Flynn, to discuss the Nazis in power, the Nazi war criminals that have passed themselves off as not being criminals. And I think you know that I'm after the man behind Henry Kissinger, his mentor, Fritz Kramer. And being as he won't answer my letter, and I've collected enough books and time on this, maybe it's time for this man to take an oath in front of Congress that he is not the Fritz Kramer that was in the dock at his prisoner 33, and he was not Hitler's Fritz Kramer. If he was, he should get the heck out of this country, and we should defrock Henry Kissinger, who's the biggest disease going. We worry about AIDS or pneumonia or heart attack or cancer. I want to do a little more on Henry Kissinger. There is a congressional committee that is sending somebody to the House. When it's over, I will tell you about it. I will tape record it so that I know what I said to them. That's a tricky thing. They come out and then report some nondescript thing. The Secret Service did that, came to my house, and I tape recorded what I said, and they wrote up their report, what I said, and they were two entirely different reports. So you can send for one from Freedom Information. So when they come, I assume it's on good faith, so I will record it and ask for a report of it, and we'll see what happens from there. That's a good step. That's a giant step in the right direction. It would make all of this time and work valuable to have this person testify under oath who he is. Now, if you have questions about Larry Flint in the news, I appreciate your concern. Don't call the House. I'm not responsible for his failure, for his failures. I use the word, maybe that's a psychological slip. He's in trouble. Deep trouble. I would like to advise him before he gets into that kind of stuff, but I don't know him that well. I didn't know him at all until this September when I said I would do a story on Larry McDonald because they were deifying him, and before the Pope came in and made him a saint, I wanted to show a little bit about Larry McDonald. I'm not responsible for the behavior of Larry Flint or the people that surround him. I can suggest ways to extricate him. I can suggest lawyers to help him. There's pretty powerful forces around there, and they seem to negate any common sense. They can't be in his best interest, but I can't step into an area like that and influence him the way I think. He did admit this afternoon, I talked with him, that certain advice I gave was the right advice, and he didn't take it. That can be very costly and painful, and why he didn't take it, I don't know. He's got these other people around, bigwigs, who give the wrong advice and you take it because you think they're your friend. In the meanwhile, they're sinking you or nailing you to the cross, whatever it is. And if you can't distinguish, and some people really can't, then they have to, you know, take the consequences of the bad judgment. There's problems at Rebel. There's a person there who is not living up to his word or promise. I don't know what will happen there. I'm not going to sacrifice anything in the terms of honesty or consistency with what I'm doing. There are people in there that would like to sabotage Mae Brussel and get her mad so that maybe she leaves or discredit her. And I'm just going to continue what I have to do and keep up my relationship with Larry Flynt if I can and let him give them orders. As I said, I never knew him before September 1983. And I'm not going to sacrifice. I'll just go back doing what I was doing before I met him, which was doing radio work and writing and accumulating material for articles and books. And when you meet somebody who wants to go with a story, you then have the material. I work just as hard, whether it's for him or I'm on my own. I never did stop the work because I don't consider it work. I like it. So don't call the house and day by day and want an account of why he's doing this or where he is, because I'm not responsible for him, and I just have enough time to keep up with what I'm doing, and I can't explain all the things that are going on there. I understand them at a level that makes it almost inevitable that these things should happen to him, but I can't extricate him alone because, as I say, he's surrounded, and there are liars around him and people who are not truthful who have lied to me, and I know they lie to Larry and are not looking out for his interest. But when you're big, when you're rich, when you think you've got it made, and when you're controversial, they step in and squash you like a little bug. And the answer is don't get so big and don't get so outlandish and go slow. And as I say, I'm an existential in that term. I don't want a big marquee and a lot of fame, and I don't want to be with people necessarily who are doing the moving and shaking, because they're not that valuable to society, most of them anyway. Most of the changes are made in quiet places by quiet people thinking things through, and people like George Seldes, I keep using his name, doing monumental work all of his life exposing fascism at his own pace. This is much more rewarding than to be with a few people for a few moments and then find out that they're infiltrated with people who are betraying you and lying with you. And luckily, I can leave that scene. That's one reason I'm up in Carmel away from L.A. I don't like that the scene of a lot of people in some big cities in this country and the way they operate. Now, I'm doing another story for The Rebel. I assume there'll be another issue. And that is going to be on the Grenada invasion, three areas, the total blackout of the press, actually four areas. The news, the unprecedented news blackout that I've talked about on this program, the questionable and interesting medical school and the people involved in Dr. Jeffrey Byrne and Peter Byrne and their past, and this Mr. Modica who set it up, the mental hospital that was bombed, and the consequences, the secrecy of it, and what I think took place, and the similarities between Grenada, the government there that existed before Mr. Bishop, the similarity of Mr. Burnham in Guyana, although one was a Marxist and the other was an outright dictator, the similarities of them, their work with our State Department, the CIA, and the similarities between Jonestown and what happened in Grenada. And they're not only close physically in proximity, but there are a lot of similarities between the two operations, the Grenada being the medical school and the mental hospital, and over nearby the People's Temple in Jonestown. So I'm doing that story, and it should be in the mail and on its way tomorrow. The New Times, which is a magazine, it's a weekly magazine that comes out from the Soviet Union, has an article about CIA Director William Casey, and they were talking about his activities getting a reward in the CIA, along with Richard Helms this last week, for great behavior. And they had an interesting sentence in this article about Casey. It said, it looks like it was in Casey's office that the idea of landing troops in Grenada was first discussed. The operation, which began with the bombing of, in quotes, a highly important strategic objective, a hospital. Okay? So I know I'm on the right track. I said that Casey got rewarded after the hospital was bombed for his great service and wiping out, it had a patient number of 180 people. And I go into the mass graves and the missing account and bodies being thrown out to sea and being dug up on the orders of Americans, and how the press was put off. And the book, The Children of Jonestown by Kenneth Wooden, there's a section in the book that refers to a man who worked for the National Security Council by the name of Robert Pastor, P-A-S-T-O-R, and he was on the staff of Zbigniew Brzezinski. And in the book, Children of Jonestown, it says that the national security was involved, and there was an impulse to save any possible embarrassment to the Carter administration. So, therefore, on orders from the Carter administration and Mr. Pastor, they removed the identification tags of people that they knew had identities. And Mr. Cobb, one of the people talking about this, said two members of his family were identified. He said, my brother, Johnny Cobb, saw tags on the people's bodies, and only two members of my family have been identified, and I want to know why, because they took them off. And in the book, The Children of Jonestown, it says that there were orders from high up that all politically sensitive papers and forms of identification were removed from the corpses, so that these ID tags were taken off of people and put into mass graves. And there's a quotation of a Lieutenant General Gordon Sumner, who said that it was the first time in his military career that he saw his men politicized, and that Robert Pastor was working for Brzezinski and President Carter's national security to save the Carter administration from embarrassment. The identity of the bodies was removed. Now, at the time of Granada, when the U.S. Army was planning to invade it, two of Jimmy Carter's top aides were telephoned by Dr. Jeffrey Byrne. He was the vice chancellor of the medical school at Granada, and he called his son Peter Byrne in Washington, who worked with Jimmy Carter. And after Mr. Bishop, Maurice Bishop, was murdered in Granada, General Hudson Austin, A-U-S-T-I-N, he's the ringleader of the group that killed Maurice Bishop, and his assistants were working with Mr. Byrne from the medical school, and they called to Washington D.C. to Robert Pastor. He was a former senior Latin American policy planner for the National Security Council, and told Pastor and Dr. Peter Byrne that there was no danger to the medical school, that the students were being taken back and forth to classes, and that the medical school was perfectly willing to work with General Hudson Austin, didn't want America interfering, and they were working with the same Robert Pastor who took the ID tags off the people at Jonestown. So when Ronald Reagan insisted on invading the island, I believe that the secrecy of keeping the press off the island for 5 days was then to have to kill everyone in the mental hospital, because this time it involved mind control. They were protecting Ronald Reagan's administration, and last time they were protecting Jimmy Carter's. So there may be important witnesses to trials in the United States, or people we're looking for who were patients in that hospital who had to be bombed. And Mr. Pastor, the same fellow that worked with Zabrinsky, Brzezinski, and Carter, was now working with Peter Byrne and Jeffrey Byrne and the people that had killed Mr. Maurice Bishop. So evidently that mental hospital went on under Sir Eric Gary, and when the medical school was formed in 1977, when Bishop was in power, evidently it was okay to have the mental hospital going. And the one thing that they didn't want was the United States troops to come in any more than they wanted Representative Leo Ryan to go into Jonestown. So it's my belief, based on a lot of secrecy and the simultaneous calls of these various people to each other, synchronized to the top people that worked during the Jonestown operation, this time in Granada. And when the president made up his mind he was going to go through with the invasion, he obliged with Caspar Weinberger of keeping the journalists off until at least the target of the hospital was bombed. And as I say, New Times said that the big operation of the CIA was to target the mental hospital, which is exactly consistent with the research that I've done. Now, the San Jose Mercury had a story this last week. Kissinger makes comeback. Ex-Secretary of State's influence is growing. He's making a strong comeback, and there's a quotation of a friend of Henry Kissinger. Henry hasn't changed. He wants to run the world. Henry's name began to surface right after the Alfred Bloomingdale tapes were silenced and Vicky Morgan had her head split open. 2 weeks later, he was back in power. Kissinger headed that Kissinger-Carrington Association that had headquarters in Barbados, that was the organizer or the pretext for invading Grenada. There were two main pretexts. One was that the organization of the various unaligned states, the small states in the Caribbean, needed to come in because the bishop was a threat, and when the coup took place, Mr. Cord was a threat, and we had been planning the invasion for 4 years. Well, Henry Kissinger is everywhere. He's in the Middle East. He's in Latin America, Central America, South America, all over the world. And he will someday, as I say, be president. He's working for the president. He's in making foreign policy. He's the foreign policy guru to the Republican president. And you just can't wash him away. The only way we'll get him, I sincerely believe, is to get to Mr. Fritz Kramer and find out who Henry Kissinger really is. I believe that sincerely. I said several years ago that, and kept on this subject, that he is a disease, and I would like to see him removed. And so we have to just keep working on this. He wants to be in power. As his friend says, he wants to have total power, and that's the important thing. Now, once the Grenada invasion took place, and I'm just going to mention a couple more things on Grenada, there was a story in the Houston Post on bringing in the U.S. Army. It says the U.S. Army general in charge of the troops in Grenada said the future role of the U.S. Army on the island would be to build a police force that would prevent any leftist revolutionaries from ever again seizing power on that island. Brigadier General Jack Farris, F-A-R-R-I-S, commander of the 82nd Airborne Division, that's the special forces, the Green Beret from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, he said the United States has already brought in sophisticated computers that will be used to register and keep track of the island's remaining leftists with the help of an extensive police intelligence system to be built by the Americans. There's 100,000 people on the island. The Libyans were sent home. The Russians were sent home. The Cubans were sent home. And now a sophisticated computer will keep track of the remaining leftists, and some of them were put into cages. There was an article about the repressions going on there of the American troops saying, okay, you took the island because you wanted democracy, and they were keeping people crawling on their hands and knees into the various cages and humiliating them and taking away a lot of their rights. There was another story in the Washington Times. The administration says other Grenada-style actions are possible. Yes, they are possible, and Mr. Weinberger and Howard Baker and the others can say there's little doubt that they wouldn't move militarily again. This is like the Anschluss of Adolf Hitler through Europe. There's no way, I can't see any way, to stop Reagan from doing what he wants. He was noticeable when he was a governor of this state. He hasn't changed at all, and now we're really getting what he promised us then, and the chickens are coming home to roost. So the computers are down there, and the rest will be history, how far they go in every other country. The New York Times had a story on Grenada aftermath, November the 7th, and it tells about George Shultz. And it said in different weeks, he's taken on new authority in recent weeks. Mr. Shultz and the State Department as a whole, backed by Vice President Bush and James Baker, they're meeting once a week as they never did before, and Mr. Shultz is emerging as a strong man in the State Department. And then it says, this is the New York Times, this was the most thoroughly planned crisis I've ever participated in, an experienced American diplomat said of the American-led invasion of Grenada. Lebanon does not have an endgame. Grenada does. In, out, and over. This was the most thoroughly planned crisis. Remember how it was just by chance that Mr. Bishop was shot and we had to come in and save the people? Someone from the Pentagon is describing it exactly as it was and how it was. And of course, Mr. Shultz works with the entire Nixon administration in various offices, and he's from Bechtel Corporation, Mr. Weinberger, and along with Henry Kissinger, they've been long friends. So they have this thing pretty well tied up. There have been some stories I haven't been able to update the last few weeks on the Civil Liberties Union suit in Los Angeles, that famous police department suit that linked to Larry McDonald and Western Goals. Western Goals is in every major city with its computers identical to the ones they're putting on Grenada to test getting rid of the leftists. keep in mind that this is a small island of 100,000 where they invaded it without one member of the press for the first time in American military history. Now they're bringing in their computers and deporting various people away from the island who had a right to live there, just sending them out of the country, just as Adolf Hitler would do, saying, get out, we'll put you on a plane, you've got to get out. Now, this kind of behavior is run by computers, it will be computerized, and the Civil Liberties Union in Los Angeles is trying, through their lawsuit, to talk about what went into the computer of Western Goals, run by the Defense Department, that goes into Germany, to Galen's BND Corporation, and to Edward Teller and Admiral Moore, the military, and Roy Cohn of the Mafia. The ACLU suit is just one city where there's a lawsuit. The others have their Western Goals computers with police departments. And because there's no lawsuit, we don't get the information. But there was one article in the Los Angeles Herald this week. The city, Los Angeles, will give the ACLU police transcripts on the condition that they're kept secret. They're ready to turn over transcripts of their private police interviews with Jay Paul, who worked for Western Goals and had that $100,000 computer. Fred Bennett, an attorney with Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, insisted that they only belong for a limited or few people in the trial, then they have to be kept secret forever. Now, Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher is the law firm that, from William French Smith that he uses, and it's Ronald Reagan's law firm, and on these tapes, there's information about the time period when Ronald Reagan was breaking law as the governor of California. J. Paul, formerly of the disbanded Public Disorder Intelligence Division, is a key figure in the allegations that the files were improperly used or removed. And the police department fought for the turnover of the tapes, and they said this is a terrible precedent for future personnel investigations, to let you hear what we're doing. They said it would have a devastating impact on internal affairs operations. This is like 1984. If we tell you what we did in the past, it will affect future operations. We can't scold you about the past because then it'll affect what we're going to do in the future. That law firm of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, Mr. Bennett, is asking the judge to limit the access of the transcripts to the plaintiffs, just to their lawyers, and then lock them up again. And the ACLU lawyer, Paul Hoffman, who's carrying the brunt of this whole case, said the public has a very important need to know what's in the material. And he's fighting. The trial's supposed to start December the 5th, and he's fighting to get that information out to us. Now, there was another article on the restriction of these police tapes, which is interesting because of the language. And the law offices are working with the police department to keep the information top secret. And the LA Times had a story. 131 groups and individuals have sued. They've charged illegal spying. And they are, this is quotes, not entitled to waltz off with something as a gift. This is what the judge said, Lester E. Olson. These people can't waltz off with a gift. He said there's no such thing as a free lunch, and they don't need to know what's on these tapes. These tapes have information. They can use it for trial preparation, but it should be locked up. Now, if you have other litigation, if you want to file with the police department, you can get it later. Judge Olson ordered that the ACLU begin receiving summaries of the tapes, and they will be given a few of the transcripts starting December and January. The disputed transcripts represent more than 250 hours of interviews with Jay Paul, who worked with Western Goals, and they have to do with 180 boxes of intelligence that went to his home and garage, with the Birch Society president and this fascist with his links to the Nazis around the world in Chile and George Habash in Lebanon and so forth. He is limited to what he has to tell them, and then it's locked up. Another 1984 argument was by the police department was that in future internal probes, this would foster police corruption. If the police today knew what the police were doing in the past, it would cause police corruption today. So this was an interesting tug of war in court last week, and they don't want the people who have the lawsuit to waltz off with a gift. With that kind of mentality of Judge Olson, you can imagine there's no such thing as a free lunch. The 131 groups and individuals have been bugged, wiretapped, had their privacy invaded, their sex life, their politics, whether they have abortions or priests or rabbis, all that is in these computers, what they do, what their family does. But they're talking about this great gift, this free lunch, if you give them too much information. Incidentally, I had a shock this weekend, a mini shock, but a young fellow who works for somebody in our family, he's trained with the LAPD, and sometimes he wants to be in the FBI. So just in conversation, I said, what would you do if you were working for the agency and you found out, say, that they lied on a particular homicide case, if there were more bullets, I was thinking of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, that were in the body, and you knew it, and they said there were two bullets, and there were eight or six. What would you do? And he said, I'd cover it up. I said, you're going into the FBI, and you would cover up a homicide if they wanted you to cover up. He said, yeah, he would cover it up. The years of idealism are over, I guess, when people join an agency admitting that they would destroy evidence or lock up evidence in these matters is here. This is what we have to face. And this is a young person, a nice person, and he was very honest. I'd just cover it up. We'll take a one-minute break now and then get back to the second part of this program. In the meantime, I wanted to ask you to, I asked you in between to give to the station and send in money. This is a fundraising week. You can donate. If you didn't hear me the first part and you just turned on World Watchers, you can contribute to the station if you want. It's appreciated. And send in a little bit if you don't have a lot. That's fair, isn't it? I always say send in a little. If you don't have a lot, send in a little and share with everybody, and we'll all get the program and a lot of other programs going at the same time. Now, this is Pledge Week, so we're going to do a lot of that this week and next week. But I usually do it anyway because I sincerely believe that people should contribute to these things and help out, and everybody do a little bit, right? Okay. You promise you'll do that?